KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Lovis Mitchell, also known as The Last Stop on Public Radio. My guest is the writer and director of one of the most interesting films of the past 10 years, I think. And it's a big departure from her first film, Lulu Wang. Her film, of course, is The Farewell. And I guess I want to say this to you, that there is a strain of absurdism that runs in your work, isn't there?
Yes.
Talk about where that comes from, because it seems to me as much a literary thing as it is a film thing. Like, when I saw The Farewell, I guess I found myself thinking about Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man and that idea of duality and how everything for people of color trying to assimilate in America, it feels like life and death. So when it comes to life and death, there becomes an extra sort of absurd quality added onto that, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that if you don't see the absurdity, if you don't laugh, how do you survive? You know, it's the only way. I mean, my parents really raised me to see everything through this lens, whether consciously or not. But my mother has a very interesting sense of humor, which, you know, she is also colored by the fact that she read a lot of Russian literature and pushed a lot of that onto me.
Which Russian literature? Pushkin or
all of it, okay. Tolstoy,
which is also the
Dostoevsky.
And there's also that kind of sense of life and death and the sense of the absurd in that there too, isn't there?
Exactly. Exactly. I forget the name of the author, but I read a long time ago because she recommended this book, Oblomov.
Oblomov, yes.
Yes.
Oh, basically life is time's a breeze passing your face.
Exactly. It's this very like existential. And I always wanted to adapt that into a modern film, the modern day Oblomov. So, I mean, I don't know, like she would use all of these analogies from literature or from philosophy, you know, ever since I was a little kid, I would do something and she would bring up Nietzsche or Kant or, you know, imagine like a 6-year-old, you know, trying to make this decision. She would be like, well, is this for the greater good or is it, you know, and so it was, it's just, I guess, a part of our everyday conversation, and it just gave me this perspective of analyzing things and seeing the humor in things.
So much of that literature, by the way, is a treatment. I misspoke. My guess is Lulu Wang, because that's just the reason she did the show last, because I couldn't get her last name right. forgive me. But what we're talking about, also in that literature too, even in Oblomov, there's a sense of somebody observing the absurdity, almost in a dispassionate kind of way. And given that you made both a broad comedy and then a more intimate, you say realistic comedy. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea of still an observer watching a world that feels crazy going on around her is really relates to this literature we're talking about.
Yeah, maybe that's the nature of being an outsider, is that you're always an observer in some ways rather than a full participant. I recently read this little blurb in a magazine about a Korean French artist who works with coal, but works out of Paris. And he said this thing that really resonated with me. He said, you know, if I was still in Korea, I wouldn't be an artist because they don't see coal as material that should be elevated. It's too mundane. It's commonplace. It's banal. But, you know, being able to leave and work from Paris using this material that's very common to his home country, he's not only a craftsman, but he's able to be an artist, and he's able to bring a different elevation to that material. And so, you know, I thought, well, maybe in a way that's the benefit of being an outsider, both in this country as well as, you know, in China.
But it's interesting, too, because there's, at least in your first one, a little bit here, too, there's this idea of class and what class means as well, and the idea of a younger person not really caring about that so much. And I really just... It's so interesting because we're talking about Russian literature. I mean, there's always a generational sweep, and the worst for the people in the middle generation, because at least the youth have the possibility of thinking they're immortal and moving ahead. But I felt that too here for Billy's parents, because they moved to the United States. So he left her culture behind, and yet they were not really a part of this culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, that strikes me as being so interesting, too, that there's this constant sort of generational schism going on in this film.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my parents are always laughing at the fact that they consider my brother and I to be socialists. We're not. We lean towards more social.
You don't know what communism is.
Right. Exactly. I mean, my friends would come over who, you know, grew up in like Andover, Massachusetts, very wealthy, very white, and claim that and they're like, well, I'm a registered communist. And my mother would just laugh. I mean, you know, having somebody who has gone through the Cultural Revolution to be in an American suburban town with my friends who are very, very come from very wealthy white American families, but are now registered communists. And so whenever my brother and I argue with them about politics, my mom just kind of gets really exasperated and throws her hands up and is like, did we leave and sacrifice everything and come to this country so our children could be communists?
I think that's interesting, though, because the idea of looking for the luxury to reject a way of thinking, which is the kind of Billy's your protagonist's dilemma here, mm-hmm. Was really interesting to me because it's something that basically is kind of a dilemma almost for people I know who are kind of third generation sort of or immigrants who just basically, well, wait a second now, or second generation where they can try to figure out which culture they belong to. And having lived with this for a while, I just wonder if Billy conceptually changed for you from the first time you started the script until you started shooting.
Changed in what way?
I mean, if she was always that kind of person trying to figure out who she was, or if she had more, if she was more wedded to a momentum at some point.
I guess in a way, she's different than me in real life, certainly. I think that I had to bring out this lack of momentum in a way for the theme of the movie, because it very much is about being in between, you know, and that lack of agency in her own life reflects or is it parallels the lack of agency she has with her grandmother, and not just with the lie itself, but the powerlessness to change any of it. You know, she's gonna have to say goodbye at some point, regardless of whether she tells her the truth or not. And also the powerlessness of her entire life. I do think that's something that I developed as I got deeper into the script, this sense of powerlessness when you're an immigrant as a child, because it wasn't your choice. And in some ways, I think I took it for granted that it was the right choice, because that's what you're told your entire life. And if you don't have that story of saying this was for good and our lives are better, then you can't justify this tremendous decision that the family has made and all of the sacrifices. So you, in a way, you continue to tell yourselves, like, of course this is the best decision and our lives are better for it. But in developing the script, I started to discover my own sense of powerlessness.
I guess I found it interesting, too, because between your first film and this is, I mean, this is really somebody who's surrounded by family and wants to be part of that. And that's kind of, for me, there seems like there are bits of you in both of these films. And this being able to communicate with family, and so many American films are about people who don't have families. Mm-hmm. And to go from these almost the kind of these two extremes you swung between in your first film and this one.
Yeah, I think that I've always had to negotiate between two different worlds. The world of my family, of Chinese culture, of food on the table every night, of that familiar love, but also pressure from my family. And then the world of America, being independent, my career, my friends. And it always felt like there was this very sharp divide between these two worlds. And so I think that Posthumous for me was me trying to ask these questions within the context of a romantic comedy, sticking to this genre, but of asking these questions about why am I doing any of this? You know, I'm trying to break free in a way, I lose a lot, right? And I sacrifice a lot in trying to break free from my family, from their desires, from being a collective. you know, in trying to be an individual. And you see so many artists who are not very happy people and who are not very whole people. And so it begs the question of, why am I doing any of that? And I think the farewell was, you know, coming back towards family and trying to see where those two worlds meet. Where do they intersect, you know? And that was the beautiful thing about this journey, that the process of making this film allowed me to bring these two worlds, these two very separate worlds together. You know, my family being on set, my producers meeting my family, so that it allowed me to see my work as an extension of my family, of my home life, of my personal life, of my voice, as opposed to a separate thing.
It almost feels like, in some ways, when you start out to make The Farewell, you were saying, this is the film I'm going to make, whether it's my last film or not. This is the movie I'm going to make. I don't know what the decision-making process was that got you there, but it seemed to be almost kind of a reaction to the broader strokes of your first film.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, you know, I didn't go to film school, so I really made my first film not knowing that it would ever get made. We were just sort of pushing this boulder uphill, and I was just, you know, driven by these questions and the script, of course, but in some ways I was driven just to make a film. I just needed to prove, I needed to, that I could make a film. And the fact that we got these tremendous actors, it was a very large production, considerably for a first feature, for someone who's never made even a short, really. So I think that, you know, the goal for me there was just to see if I could even get to the finish line and surprise myself and my family by finishing it and you know, it feeling like a very sizable production. And it shifted the way that my parents looked at me, because before that, they just thought films, like, there's no one like you making, how can you make films? You didn't go to film school. How do you even know how to direct? And so in a way, it was I needed to prove to them that I was going to make a film and not just a short film. And I don't mean just because I don't value short films, but I needed to do something really substantial.
But also, it's a really expansive short film. You cover a lot of ground, and there are a lot of ideas that you're touching on in that film. In Posthumous. You go through a lot. You cover a lot. You cram a lot into it. And that's the fascinating difference for me, is that that's so dense, and The Farewell is so full of air. I mean, it's got very different breathing rhythms, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And it probably speaks to where I was and where I am as an artist. You know, I was in my 20s when I was making Posthumous, and in a way, I felt like, you know, if I'm going to do something, I got to put it all in there. You know, it's this like, I think it's one of the benefits of getting older. When you're younger, you're just like more, more, more. You know, big, like everything. And in a way, trying to prove yourself. And with this film, it was like, I asked myself one question for the majority of the film. How does one say goodbye? And that was it, you know? I think that to take something so unanswerable and so simple and try to expand that and try to translate that onto screen, you know, and make people, you know, feel something.
We're going to take a break, not say goodbye. We'll be back with more of my guest, Lulu Wong. Her first feature film is The Farewell. It's a treat with this. More to come. Stay with us. I'm going to get everything wrong today. It's The Treatment, my guest, whose second film is The Farewell, Lulu Wong. But I guess I was saying with Posthumous, too, is I felt like, I wonder if you were dealing with genre there, because it just felt easier to try to put ideas into almost a Trojan horse.
Yes and no. I mean, the fact that I was working within a genre was because my financier and producer, Bernadette, she came to me wanting to make a romantic comedy. And, you know, that was how the conversation started, was her saying, you know, I really miss the romantic comedies of the 50s, those screwballs, you know, or even the early 90s. Something charming, something thoughtful. And so we started talking, and I had pitched her a few ideas. And so I think the genesis of how the project started was through the lens of making the intent of making a romantic comedy always.
Because I guess it's interesting, too, if we look at The Farewell, and this is the point you should probably tell the audience what the movie's about, because we've been talking in sort of these theoretical terms about it. But give a sort of, if you will, a précis of the story of The Farewell.
The Farewell is loosely based on my family. My grandmother was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer a few years ago. And my family told me this and said, you know, she's given by the doctor about 3 months to live. But in China, they usually don't tell the patient. They'll tell the family members instead and let the family decide when it's best to tell the patient. And in our situation, our family decided it would be best not to tell her at all, at least for the time being. And we needed to go see her. And so in order to create an excuse for us to see her without making her suspicious, they used my cousin and his girlfriend and had them get married and have a wedding as the premise under which we were all going to have this reunion.
I guess I was thinking a little bit that the way we meet your protagonist, Billy, it's almost like meeting a screwball comedy heroine. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like meeting Carol Lombard or My Man Godfrey or something like that, where she's not really connected to the real world, and but it's clearly somebody who's full of feeling and is living this life that she sort of set out for herself to sort of show that she's not part of her family. But by the end, she is part of her family in ways that I think are even surprising to her. And it could have been a much – you could have played it for – because it is, as we were saying in the first half of the show, kind of an absurd premise for those of us who are Westerners. Mm-hmm. You could have played it more for comedy, but you obviously made a decision to sort of make it as real as possible, didn't you?
Yeah, and in some ways the absurdity is Billy herself as the lone Westerner kind of charging in, thinking that she's right, you know, despite this like very ancient culture and these very wise people who are much older and much more experienced than her. For her to go, but truth, freedom, America. I mean, that's the absurdity.
But there is almost a really 20th century kind of American narcissism that goes back to Scott Fitzgerald, this idea of the individual thinking that the role is about them when in fact it is not. And I mean, I just think about, for me, this seems like she's trying to talk to the doctors who are going, no, this seems fine. What are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
That she's looking for somebody to tell her that she's right.
Exactly.
And I don't want to give too much away by going on to what happens, but that character, as I said, by the idea of her, at least she thinks she has agency because she's got a mission.
Right.
And basically the second half of the movie, which makes it go from feeling almost like a Mike Lee movie to a screwball comedy in mm-hmm. some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I go between those two genres, if you will, like, you know, because, yeah, it's sometimes in my mind I thought it was a screwball comedy. The setup is certainly screwball. But then in scenes that are more intimate with the family where you're trying to understand the characters and their own relationships to the grandmother and this loss and what that means, it goes much more in the Mike Lee direction. Yeah. But I mean, I think even the sense of agency is very Western, you know, both in like life and in screenwriting, right? Because you go, got to have agency, got to have catharsis. We've got to sort of break this thing open. And from an Eastern philosophy perspective, it's like, why? You know, what you want to achieve is balance. So why do you want conflict?
Because I was wondering, too, though, if you ever thought about making it play more melodramatically at some point, because you could have.
I guess so. I mean, we certainly talked about that in the development process. But for me, the melodrama is internal, and that's part of the comedy. I've always been fascinated with that, both in this film and Posthumous, you know, the melodrama of an artist, you know, like my voice. You know, like, this isn't for money, it's about love.
There's something almost self-satirizing about that character, though.
Absolutely.
That need to dramatize everything.
Exactly, you know. But on the business side, people do as well, and they're just like, somebody's got to keep the roof over our heads, right? And so I think whichever direction you go, people are all cliches. We're all cliches. We're all some form of, as much as we fight that, we're all some form of a stock character.
Well, some of us might say archetype, but yes, we'll
archetype,
go.
Archetype. Yes, that's a good one.
I'm stung so much. That's okay. I'll stick with being a cliche, but that you like playing with, I mean, because you do play with archetype and theme, and that's why I was asking you when we got started about literature, because that feels to me like a much more literary approach than a filmic approach, and hearing that you weren't really a film student, mm-hmm. and that so much of this came out of literature, because there is, you mentioned Russian literature, and there's almost a, you know, laughing at the gallows kind of sense to a lot of that stuff. But there's also, I mean, as much as if you were to explain to somebody the story of Abramoff, it would be kind of terrifying. But there's also
try to pitch that in a Hollywood, like, pitch meeting. So I want to make this feature film. He does nothing. For the first 40 minutes, he can't get out of bed.
And again, time is a breeze passing his face. Just leave it like that. Yeah. But there's also something really lyrical about that. And as we were talking about that, I thought about Billy in that way, where time is this thing. We can sort of see the connection between her and her grandmother in that way, and how fast time moves. And it feels like Abramoff a bit to me, in that there's a connection in some ways, Billy and her grandmother, the same person, and time passing so quickly. You know, at least I felt like in some spiritual way you could say that Abramoff was part of the way you think.
Yeah, I do think that the sense of being an immigrant when you go back, you know, to your home country, it's almost like how people say you can't see yourself gaining weight if you're looking in the mirror every day or changing or growing older. But if there's periods of time that you don't see a person, other people recognize it much more because they see the before and they see the after, and not the slow transition in between. And so that is the feeling of going back to China regularly, but not often enough, is that every time you go back, things are so significantly different. You really see people's aging. I mean, that's something I experience now with my parents, too, as they're getting older, because I'm not with them every day. And every time I go back, I go, oh, did they always look like that? Are they getting older? Was he limping like that before? And, you know, you start to notice these things, and I think you just sense time passing in a much more visceral way.
I guess I was thinking, too, about what even airplane travel does, mm-hmm. going back and forth across continents, and just the way, in fact, Billy is greeted when she comes back, which is both this kind of funny thing, because it doesn't seem that big a deal to her, but she's kind of like an invading force, which, mm-hmm. again, becomes to me kind of the comedy in this film, too.
Yeah. Yeah, they see her in a way a bit like that. The uncle, you know, the extended family members, this is sort of like a Western force that is somewhat uncontrollable, because we all know that Americans are too transparent. We wear our hearts on our sleeves. We like to express our truth. And so I think that they see her as a threat in that way, because it's going to be drama, and for good reason, because look, honestly, if I think back on my childhood, on my growing up, we caused a lot of drama. Every time we went home to my grandparents' house, we'd get into an argument about something in front of my grandmother. As much as we don't want to make her bear witness to that, somehow it would come up. My mother would blame me for my brother dropping out of college and turn into this massive fight, and my poor grandmother would just be sitting on the side being like, can we not fight? Like, you guys are home for 3 days.
There's part of it too is, again, it's time to try and compress so much into a short visit, and of course there are going to be tensions because you're putting pressure on yourself. But I thought it was interesting too that you cast somebody in your lead who's not known as being a dramatic actress, but who clearly in Awkwafina, who understands the weight of words. And the way her speaking rhythms change, mm-hmm. when she's, it's almost like she's paying more attention initially to what she's saying, but it's also because there's so many things going on. But I want you to talk a little bit about that too, and finding that with her, because she sounds like a different person once she leaves America too, and not just in speaking the language, but also the way she's aware of her words.
Yeah, and that's very much a testament to Nora's performance, because that's very real. You know, she learned Chinese for this movie. She doesn't really speak Chinese as well as the character does. And I speak pretty fluently, so we kind of found this in between, and I tailored the character more for her speaking abilities. And she had a dialect coach. But yeah, there's this sort of frustration, but also a carefulness when you don't speak the language. When you speak fluent Chinese, it just kind of flows. It's very melodic as well. But when you don't speak it well, it comes out quite harsh and kind of stilted.
I mean, I clearly don't speak Chinese, but it was evident to me that it's almost like she's watching the words come out of her mouth.
Yes.
Which I thought was really interesting, because there's almost a carelessness the way she's talking to her parents on the phone when she's in America. And, yeah, well, I know if I just sort of say this, this is what they want to hear.
Yeah.
And so this conversation won't go any further. But there's an awareness of the weight and the power of words when she's in China. That I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, and it's just another way in which you're relegated to being a child in front of your parents, in front of your family in China, because you don't have the language. And so sometimes I'm arguing with my parents and I want to be taken seriously and I have a very serious point that I'm making, and I'll be like, you know, but you didn't even close the door. And my mom will be like, you don't even know what you just said. That's not the word for door, right? You know, or whatever, you just said toilet or whatever it is, you know?
Well, if that's not a theme for a movie, I don't know what it is. Because I guess it's, again, this is so much about absurdity. And if you think about what literature does and that sense of how words matter, and for Abumov, just this obsession of sort of detailing this world that's going on, that's spinning without him participating in it. I don't mean to keep going back to that, but
no, I love it.
But I was also, I really did find myself thinking a lot of, I don't know if you've read Baldwin's Invisible Man, but that also that sense of being an observer and watching an absurd world where life and death is a play going on around it too. That's what I found myself thinking about as much as anything. And both of these films you've done can almost be short stories. And I wondered at some point if you'd ever start to write them as prose pieces and then they became film, or how you arrived at this.
With The Farewell, I did, actually, because I didn't think that I was going to get to make it into a feature. And so I come from a writing background. I've been writing since I was very young. My mother's a writer. So I thought, well, if I can't tell the story the way I want to in film, because the people I initially talked to kept wanting to push it towards a broader comedy, I came back and said, well, you know, what's important for me is just to get these words down, these experiences down on paper. So I wrote it as a short story and actually put it aside, but it was this short story that I submitted to This American Life. When Neil Drumming, the producer, came to me, he said, do you have any stories? I said, well, there's one I wrote a very first rough draft of as a short story. So don't judge me on my writing, but it kind of tells the story.
So it went from being a film to then a short story to then This American Life to then being a film again.
Exactly. And maybe that's why, going back to what you were saying about how this film feels much more simple, like it feels more minimalistic. And I think that is because I went back to prose.
Well, we're out of time. We do have to say goodbye now, or I'm not going to say farewell, because that's the name of the film, The Farewell. My guest is Lulu Wong. Thanks again for so much for doing this. I'm just really impressed by the weight of words in it and just how that was like a lesson learned from Posthumous to this.
Thank you.
You made the film. I'm just making small talk. Our recording engineer here at NPR is Marcia Caldwell. The show is mixed by Kat Yours, edited by Blake Veit. Farewell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.